Okay, this is talking with L.A. Manning at his home in Palo Alto, California on 18 June 1979. Could you tell me what your educational background was and how you first came in contact with radar astronomy, as we call it now?
Yes, well, I got a bachelor's in electrical engineering at Stanford in 1944, and then I went back for about a year and a quarter to the Radio Research Laboratory at Harvard University, where they were doing work on radar countermeasures.
Right.
And what I did back there was work with reflex klystron oscillators in the microwave region. But my interest in or activity in connection with the ionosphere actually started when I was a senior at Stanford. I was offered a job servicing an ionospheric sounding transmitter. And from that, it developed into developing records and then to analyzing routine ionospheric sounding records.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was interested in you know, what they meant. So I did some research and wrote a paper in which I analyzed how to interpret the electron density versus height in the ionosphere from these multi-frequency sounding records. So then I went back to Harvard, and when I was there, I made contact with Felix Bloch, who asked me to come back as a physics student.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back to Stanford after that, and I spent a year in the physics department working with Felix Bloch and Hansen. They were working on nuclear magnetic resonance. But then I had an opportunity, by going back to electrical engineering, to get a sponsored project where I could do a survey on the literature of the ionosphere,
right,
which I did for the Air Force. So I then moved back there and was starting a PhD program and reading just about all the ionospheric literature I could get my hands on and abstracting this. And then in 1946, the newspapers announced we're going to have this Jacobinid meteor shower. And that is meant to be a very intense one and rather rare and so forth. So I was talking with several of the graduate students there. Bob Hellowell was one, about this, and saying it's really something that we should make a study of.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned that Mike Villard had some interest in meteors. That he was a radio amateur, and he'd listened to some signals, that whether sort of whistling noises that might be associated with meteors, and so
mm-hmm.
he thought he might be interested. So we decided that three of us plus another fellow, Evans, that was working with Villard at the time. Villard was doing research on single sideband radio transmitters.
Mm-hmm.
That we'd see if we couldn't set up some way of noting these. So we got a radio receiver and tuned it to a station where we could detect enhancements of signals due to meteors, and we also.
Well, the abstract here says 100 kilowatt broadcast station. This was already existing station.
It's an already existing broadcast station.
Right.
So we simply set up a receiver, and where we could observe this, and we also did some visual observation and took a few photographs.
What kind of a station was this?
Darn if I remember exactly what station it was.
15 megacycles.
15 megahertz. It was a continuous wave transmitter at some distance, and the key factor was that in addition to any signals that would be coming directly from that station, there might be enhanced signals coming from the meteors, and
mm-hmm.
the ionization trails that moved in would produce another component of signals, a Doppler frequency shift.
Right.
And so we get a whistling sound as you get a beat between the Doppler shifted signal from the meteors and those that
right.
are coming directly in.
Were you recording just listening, or were you recording on a strip chart also? Or?
I don't remember if we had a strip chart on that particular occasion. We certainly did not long after that.
I can take a look at the paper.
Yeah, I don't remember that we had a strip chart. It really wasn't very quantitative, except in doing some counting
yeah.
of the rates and so forth and getting a feel for the phenomena's existence.
And did you try to correlate with optical meteors?
We had people indoors, outdoors watching and listening inside, and we'd find at times that there was a definite correlation. We'd see one coming in, a big one coming in, there'd be mm-hmm. a big whistle. Mm-hmm. It became quite obvious that that it was meteors that was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And although, as you mentioned, there had been previous observations of skeleton various people, there also was a paper in the literature denying that there was any connection, and it seemed worthwhile.
And you knew about this from your bibliographic search, of course. And, So it was really by chance that you set this up. So after you had this successful small experiment, then mm-hmm. what did it strike you to do next?
Well, the thing that I wanted to do next was to apply some theory to it to see, for example, why the whistlers be at a certain frequency and what one could deduce from it and whatnot. This next paper that came along.
48, Journal of Applied Physics. Right.
It was basically setting up some geometry and saying that if you come in at a certain speed, you should get a certain amount of Doppler shift, and mm-hmm. the whistler really should fall down. And if you set up an arrangement with three stations and do a certain type of triangulation, of course, you always have to have a normality of the reflecting line,
but right.
that you could then figure out where they're coming from.
But now, when did you become aware of the British work that was being done on that very same shower in 1946, as a matter of fact?
Well, we didn't know about that until later when it was published.
When it came out in Nature. So that's there was no knowledge before you saw it in Nature.
No, there was no knowledge of that work that was going on in that shower.
I don't think there were there any other groups that looked at that independently? I don't think there were.
As far as the published literature is concerned, I'm not sure that there was. There were probably some informal observations.
So you worked out the theory, and from the tone of your voice, it seems like it was reasonably straightforward to apply known properties of the ionosphere to what you would expect here.
These things come in very straight lines, right. and they produce ionization, which is essentially linear, and so the geometry is really quite precise at the moment that they're new. Of course, they get ragged and blown around and stuff like that.
But at least for this first cut, it was straightforward. But from an experimental point of view, what did you think was the way to go to find out more about these trails?
Well, the first thing experimentally was to get the transmitter under our control, so we'd have control of the complete experiment. And the next experiments that we did involved setting up a continuous wave transmitter of our own. We have to move it a certain distance from the receiver just to keep it from blocking it, but we put the transmitter maybe three or four, five miles away, and
mm-hmm.
They showed our location, and then we could make quantitative measurements using a signal that had no modulation on it, and which was under our control.
And this was the one that was used for this Perseid shower in 1948.
Probably.
It was in Journal of Applied Physics, also published in 1949.
It would be. Yes.
And now, in studying these things, what was your primary motivation? I gather that it was not so much to study the meteors and their origin as to study the ionosphere. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Well, we weren't thinking that here's the ionosphere and that necessarily we want to know about the ionosphere, but here we have a phenomenon. And it's an interesting phenomenon, and in fact it's even sort of a romantic phenomenon. You go out at night and these things come with you and you see lights and stuff. The question: what's happening,
uh-huh.
and what can you learn from it? And so we try to figure out what is the effect, how you'd analyze it, and then we keep looking at it and seeing what else would show up. And we'd find, for example, that there weren't just these whistlers. As it's coming in, there'd be the Doppler effect, and the whistling sound would go down like that. But then the signal would rise up in amplitude after that, which implied that there must be an expansion of the size of the ionization.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the signal will go away. So there'd be information about the size of the meteor in terms of the amount of ionization produced. There must be some information about how high in the atmosphere this is occurring. That must tell something about the atmosphere. And then we found from using these continuous observations something we probably wouldn't have found if we'd be using a pulse radar. And that is that there was a very low frequency Doppler shift of the order of a few cycles per second in this later, what we call it, a body of the echo. And this appeared to be a result of the drift of the whole ionization by wind motion in the ionosphere.
I see. So that was an accidental discovery, so to speak.
That was discovered because we made the measurements, and there it was, you see.
It wasn't something you said, let's try to study winds. And
no, we didn't say, let's study winds, but we said, let's see what we can get in the way of echoes, and we found this effect.
Hmm.
So then we tried to figure out what we could learn from it.
Now, was there much knowledge at all about ionospheric winds at this time in the late 40s?
Well, not at that altitude. Of course, there have been some visual observations of the drift of meteor trains, and the fact that they were distorted suggested the winds weren't uniform in height. But it was a hard region to make measurements. There weren't any rockets or anything up there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for quite a while, the only other way really of making measurements was, and I guess this probably came along more or less about the same time, it was if you transmit radio signals reflected off the lower part of the ionosphere, the irregularities would produce fading patterns which drift. And
then, of course, in later years, you can use radio sources and how the fringes behave.
Plus, you can also put up various sorts of releases from rockets and let them drift around and things of that sort.
But that came along a good bit later. So it looks like in 1950 you have a theoretical paper primarily about how you can measure the altitudes, the winds at about 100 kilometers altitude.
Mm-hmm.
So you were working out this theory in the late 40s, apparently.
Yeah. Notice this paper that came just before that. That's really something left over from the work I did as a senior. That was the ionospheric sounding and the...
Oh, I see.
I wrote two papers on that.
In Proceedings of IRE in 49.
Yeah, these are not meteor papers. But,
right.
And actually, I use that other work for my PhD thesis.
Which you got what year?
In 49. That sort of left the way open for Pilar to use all the meteor stuff that he wanted because there's plenty of stuff to go around.
Now, during the late 40s, when you became aware of these other groups, mm-hmm. Was there much correspondence or contact at meetings?
There's contact at meetings, and there really wasn't correspondence. We wouldn't write and say what you're doing or like that. It was really a sort of a more competitive situation. I guess we had a bit of the feeling that the group at Manchester felt that they were the only people in the world and that everything that was discovered obviously were the things that they discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you would just simply have to go to the meetings and state your case otherwise.
Yeah.
Which meetings were these? IRSI?
Well, we go to IRSI meetings and we also go to the international IRSI meetings.
Mm-hmm.
That was a primary meeting outlet.
What would you say were the other primary meteor radar groups of this time?
Well, I would say that there were three principal groups. The one McKinley had up in Ottawa, and the one at Manchester under Lovell and mm-hmm. in our group. Later on, Australians got into some work, primarily in connection with measuring drifts and that sort of thing.
I don't remember that. That was... When, in the mid-50s?
That was, I guess in probably the late 50s.
Oh, yeah, that
late,
the 60s, okay.
Yeah,
right.
Kind of later. Yeah. But those were the principal places where this was going on.
So your philosophy apparently was to, as you were saying, just understand this phenomenon as much as you can.
Yeah.
But still, you were confining yourself to understanding it in terms of an ionospheric physicist. You weren't... interest in following up the astronomical side of things.
No, we really weren't. And we looked at that, we figured that there are certain problems in doing that, quite apart from interest. One is that it would require, to do it properly, becoming takers of large amounts of statistical data.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't really interested in doing, we were more interested in developing methods than in taking data. We figured that taking data was something that somebody else had surely come along and do, and it was kind of dull.
Right.
It's much more fun if we could find some physical.
Right.